This is Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. You've probably heard about STEM. That's the acronym for Science, Technology, Engineering, and Math. Boosting STEM education in support of a high-tech economy has been a top priority for President Obama. Last year, he committed $3.1 billion to STEM education initiatives. But there are those who say the ubiquitous acronym is missing a letter, A, for art. Rhode Island School of Design, or RISD, is at the forefront of the STEM to STEAM movement. They, and many artists, say integrating arts and science is more than a nicety. It's a necessity if we're to train a generation with both the knowledge and creativity required to meet the challenges we face. So today we're at RISD getting a firsthand look at what STEAM can do and be. We're with Dennis Helinski, professor of fine arts, and Babette Alina, director of government relations. Welcome to Living Lab.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Now, Dennis, behind us we have this huge screen showing one of your video pieces. You are a video artist. And this video has really caught on the web recently, and it's essentially, I guess, well, you describe it. It's not exactly time-lapse, but it's of birds on electric wires and kind of tracking their movement as they fly.
Basically, the technique has been described as an airplane contrail, where as the bird flies, it leaves a tracing behind it. I began to think of it in a kind of slightly different way, and that is that most video allows you to see a 30th of a second at a time. This allows you to see what has transpired over 2 seconds or 3 seconds at a time. So all I've really done is expanded the moment in which we're observing.
Well, and it's really beautiful. I mean, you do get these trails like contrails where you can see where the bird has flown. But within that, what makes up the trail is individual images of the bird. And so you can see the bird with wings down and then wings up and wings down and wings up. And you get to see a little bit of their behavior and the physics of how they move when you're watching this.
Well, it's really interesting. It's not just birds that I've been recording, but ants and little white bugs that I don't know the name of, and water striders and crows and different species. And what I've been finding is that every species has its own gesture. And so I was looking at a recording that I'd made of a group of starlings that were flying around on wires. And in the background, or flying kind of in this area of Seekonk that has a lot of box stores. I mean, there are Walmarts and everything else. And then through the frame, there's this other little squiggly line, and I could identify it as a crow, just because of the way the bird was flying. And this kind of species identification has a name in the birder community, and it's called GIS. It's just like the gist of the species. And identifying that species through just the gesture, just the movement of the flock.
So how did you get started on this? What gave you the idea to try to film animals in this way?
Well, I got started, you know, photographing when I was 17, and I'm 61 now, you know. So I've been photographing and recording for a long time. And these recordings, these sort of documents that I make are very personal documents. So I often carry a camera with me. As the technology has changed, I've gone from port-a-packs weighing, you know, 30 pounds to pocket cameras that you can carry around in your pocket to cell phones. But there was this period of time about 5 years ago when a company called Flip and Kodak produced these wonderful, fairly good quality pocket cameras that you could carry around. They weren't very expensive, $75, something like that. And so I would wake up early, walk around the neighborhood, and before anybody was up and around. I live in this neighborhood where there are a lot of people that feed birds and squirrels, and so there's this wildlife that occurs at sunrise. What I would start to do was this kind of activity of dropping this camera in the snow, turning it on, dropping it in the snow, going off, having a cup of coffee, coming back and sort of seeing what happened. It was a gesture of surveillance more than anything else. And out of that, I started processing the film. And when I started processing the film, I began to notice these patterns that were really quite unexpected, but really rather beautiful. And those were the patterns that the birds made. And there were things that I had never seen before. They were gestural loops. They were glyphs in the sky. They looked like pencil drawings. They looked like these wonderful marks that were being made, you know, by these little creatures. And then you begin to ask the questions. Whether they're scientific questions or not, they're artistic questions. And that's, why are they doing what they're doing? Are there forms, are there shapes to doing what they're doing? If I can look at these as a group, because that's essentially what I was doing, widening the period of time that I was looking at them, then what would happen would be that the movement of the flock itself became the thing that I was looking at.
Yeah, I mean, the videos are mesmerizing. We should say we'll have an example on our website and a link to your Vimeo stream. Okay. So people can see what it is that we're talking about here. I mean, it's completely mesmerizing, but you're talking about processing the film, and anytime you're processing the film, you're making a selective choice.
Well, you're also making a selective choice as to where to point the camera. I mean, that's...
So that's, what is it that... Is there a message, or is there something that you're hoping viewers take away from your videos when they look at these patterns in these videos?
Well, that depends on when you're talking to me and who I'm talking with. There are a lot of discussions that have occurred around these videos, because they're not video recordings that I would ever show in front of a big audience where I would ask them to be quiet and just look at what I've done. They're not narrative in that way. What they are is they kind of function more like long paintings, you know, long kind of kinetic works that people pass through, they walk by, they stop, they chat to their neighbor, they talk about things. And some of the conversations that I've gotten into while watching these have strayed into areas of DNA, strayed into areas of individuality. They somehow elicit something that we humans do extraordinarily well, and that's make sense out of complete and total chaos.
My husband is a scientist, and we were looking at some of these videos. And of course, you get two people looking at any piece of art, and you'll have two completely different interpretations. But you're exactly right. I mean, the two of us sat there, and questions kept bubbling up, and they were completely different questions between the two of us. There was one point where you can see most of the birds are sitting still on a wire, but there every once in a while there's one that kind of scoots along the wire and moves. And well, what makes that one different? Why does that one feel the need to move when the others don't? And my husband's response was actually, look at all that data.
Right. Yeah, it's a tremendous amount of data. I mean, for a while I was looking at the birds, and I was doing measurements between the 30th of a second, you know, because there's a pattern of wing up, wing down, no wing. That you see when their birds are flying sideways. And then you can measure head-to-head between the spots of the trails, and you can determine how fast the bird was flying, because you know that each one of those individual frames was taken 29.97 seconds apart, or 29.2997 seconds apart. Because you have 30 frames per second.
Right.
So you can look at it as data. I've been wanting to do stereo imaging and look at point cloud information, that sort of thing. One of the curious things that's happened over the past week is that I've been getting emails from scientists and people that are studying birds and bird behavior from all over the world. And in the staff newsletter in a college in Amsterdam, the video was shown as an example of an interesting artist work relevant to science. And I thought that was a really very interesting way of posing the work that artists do in relationship to the sciences.
In terms of your relationship to the sciences. I mean, you know, we've been talking about the bird video, but it struck me in particular with your video of water striders, that in the description that accompanies the video online, you talk about the logarithmic deceleration of their leaps, essentially, that, you know, and you're talking about the exact timing of the wing up, wing down pattern. How much do you delve into the mathematics of these behaviors, and how much is that simply a necessity for being able to process the video in the way that you want to? And how much of that, I guess, somehow feeds into your just greater understanding or relation to the behaviors in the videos?
I think the question is an interesting question, but it points towards something that's, I believe, very specific to an artist practice as opposed to a science practice. That often, if you engage in a science practice, basically the group of STEM practices, science, technology, engineering, you know, that's math, that what you're really doing is looking by and large at this very reductive kind of thinking, where what you do is you form a hypothesis, you isolate the thing that you're looking at, you test the thing that you're looking at, you look at those data points. You want data points that are dependable. You want to collect a lot of them. You want to analyze a lot of them. But that first moment, that first practice, is to separate the things that you don't understand about the things that can produce concrete knowledge. Does that make any sense?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely.
And so, but I think artists work in a completely different way. What an artist will do is unbridle their mind. They'll look at the entire information horizon around them, or their entire information horizon that is specific to an area, and take everything in. They won't isolate something. They won't isolate it in terms of what its function is. An artist might go an artist designer might go into a large box company and look at the parking lot and say, well, this parking lot is a solar collector. This parking lot is looks like a cistern, you know, a collector of water. This parking lot looks like a place for lovers. This parking lot looks like, you know, it can transform into all of these different things because we're not narrowing our vision of what the parking lot is given our predisposed idea of what it is. So what happens with me anyway is that I go into this area where I'm just looking at lots of small animals moving around. And I begin to ask as many questions as I can, not trying to figure anything out exactly, but to amass these very, very general data points. And then what I do is I begin to make narratives. I begin to stitch all of those little pieces of information together, and I begin to say, maybe they're here because the wires are warm and they're cold. Maybe they're here because some of them are old and some of them are young, and the young ones want to mate and the old ones want to just stay on the wire because they're tired of flying around. You know, like I can impose those kinds of evaluations on the, I can call them marks of God. I can call them anything that I want as an artist. And in doing that, what I do is I create possible ways that they can be viewed. And if I started with just trying to figure out what the point cloud data, you know, looked like from one specific bird, which is a much more reductionist way of looking at it, I'd never get there.
But at the same time, perhaps you're starting from a different point in terms of your knowledge of the processes, but those alternative perspectives you could call hypotheses. Maybe they're here because of this. That's essentially a hypothesis.
You certainly could call them hypothesis. And I think that we do. I mean, we can in the scientific community. And I think that that's one of the things artists can bring to the scientific community because they're not constrained by looking at very specific things. They're entering that research environment, that all of the information that is included in that research environment, and beginning to ask questions. When planktons spin, you know, all planktons spin. are they light meters? When they spin, are they blinking on and off? When, because the light is just coming from one direction. You know, it's like I can ask that question as an artist, whereas a scientist may not get to that place. And I can only ask it as an artist because, you know, I've spent time modeling their paths and their behaviors in a 3D program. And I can place a camera where the plankton is swimming. And I can sort of begin to see what is going on with that. But those are small hypotheses for me. I'm not trying to create concrete knowledge out of it. I'm creating stories. I'm creating the thing that humans do best, which is, you know, make sense out of the world.
You're listening to Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. I'm here at RISD today talking with Professor Dennis Linsky. Also with us is Babette Alina, the Director of Government Relations. We'll talk more after a short break. You're listening to Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. We're at Rhode Island School of Design today, exploring the benefits of integrating art and science. We're with Professor Dennis Linsky and Babette Alina, Director of Government Relations. Now, before the break, Dennis, you were explaining how you see your process as being, as an artist, as being distinctly different from a scientist's process. And Babette, I actually want to turn to you. You've worked in the realm of STEAM and kind of promoting this integration of arts and sciences. What does that artistic process offer to scientists or to the field of science?
So we've learned of a lot of examples where artists have, because of this broad approach or just sort of empathizing with the environment, are able to see things, literally see things or understand things that perhaps were lost in a more narrow, or I shouldn't even say narrow, but a very targeted or intentional approach from the scientists. So one general statement I would make is that adding the symbolic A to STEM disciplines adds the ability that Dennis alluded to for artists to ask questions. There's a risk-taking that artists are very comfortable with that often in the sciences is left by the wayside. Students that are coming up in the STEM disciplines, and you spoke about the tremendous investment in STEM education, are succeeding to a certain point, but there's a lot of pressure on them, particularly if they come from families where they're the first student to go to college or whether they're representing their community as a student who has received a fellowship or what have you. And there's a real fear of failure. They're propped up to do well, and they're not asking questions. They're learning information that at a certain point where they have to innovate, they're struggling a little bit. And artists are natural innovators because of the kind of approach we take that Dennis described.
And so you think that by incorporating, perhaps trying to teach that process to students at an earlier age, you end up with students that then are more prepared actually to take on the challenges of a STEM higher education or career.
Absolutely. And we've often spoken about this at RISD in terms of students who learn critical thinking and critical making, which is sort of hands-on understanding of materials, have these skills that are transferable. So that's what I'm at RISD, what I'm alluding to exists as what we call critical thinking and critical making.
So Dennis, then kind of translate that for us into this example of your work that we've been talking about. I mean, in a lot of ways, the way you were describing your process, we would think of as the opposite of critical, just kind of all-encompassing, all-accepting, and then just see what comes out of it. How is critical thinking a part of that?
Well, I think that for me, since I'm the chair of the film, animation, and video program, that I've framed much of my work in terms of time. And so when I look at something that I've recorded, I think about the framing. I think about how I can do it. I can achieve a more interesting result. I look at it in terms of whether or not, for me, it occupies that critical point, sort of somewhere between, you know, over-exuberance and catatonicness. You know, it's like there's this, I think every alive thing balances somewhere between this a kind of epilepsy and catatonic, maybe, you know, where if you kind of move in one direction or another, you either die or you become absolutely crazy. You know, we live in these kind of balancing points as general organisms, as collections of cells, as you know, because you could think of our cells as flocks that are moving together. Well, how do we hold ourselves together? How do we, you know, it's like there are questions that one asks. So when I've recorded something and I'm looking at the footage that I've processed, and sometimes it takes a very, very long time to process it. Right now I've got one clip that I'm processing, and it's been 96 hours or something like that.
For how long of a film?
6 minutes.
That's quite an investment.
Well, it's rendering in the background. It keeps me company for a couple of days. You know, it's good. But what happens to me is that when I look at it, I look at it and evaluate it. I'm only making it because I've observed something. I've observed a particular behavior in these creatures. Like, we have in Providence about 5,000 to 6,000 crows that congregate for 15 minutes before sunset during the coldest months of the year on the east side of Providence that very, very few people have ever seen. I think it's just fascinating. When I'm looking at those crows, I'm trying to figure out how they congregate. You know, I form these little narratives. If I follow this family from, you know, the neighboring community and see where they go, do they join up with the big one? How long does it take them to come together? You know, that kind of asking, what kind of camera should I use? Is the camera that I'm using good in low light? Will it? Do I have to shoot toward the west when the sun is setting? Do I have to shoot toward the east? If I shoot toward the east, I get a black sky behind me. You know, and so what happens is that because the sun is setting, you know, if I shoot toward the west, then everything's in silhouette. I kind of like that. And so you ask lots and lots and lots and lots of questions in your process.
And the whole time that you're emphasizing how your process is different from science, I have to say what I'm seeing is incredible parallels between the two processes, that it's about questions, it's about observations, it's about critical thinking, it's about understanding our world. Babette, Alina, I wonder if in trying to incorporate art into science education, you're talking about the fear of failure in terms of knowing the right answer. Can you use art to essentially teach the scientific method?
I can try to answer that. I would also say in the culture of critique, is that the question we're trying to answer? I don't know. We try to avoid art in service to science or conversely science in service to art. And I think what Dennis's work does is it's a beautiful marriage of the two fields. And one of the reasons it's so successful and such a wonderful example of what STEAM is at RISD, which is a question we often get. But I would say that by adding art and design into STEM education, some of the evidence that's coming out, and this is primarily anecdotal because it's such a new concept, as STEAM at least, that students, first of all, in whatever discipline they're engaged, become more engaged. It creates more of a fabric for them to hang on to in any topic area. It's another door in for a lot of students who aren't necessarily rote learners or who aren't necessarily understanding the real-life applications of learning algebra. If they're learning math through music, if they have a musical ear, that's just another door in. So the A, which we all often say is a symbolic A for many disciplines, including the liberal arts. We are at an art and design school, so for RISD it is an A for art. But many people relate to this. And what we're seeing is that by having art and design in the classroom, students are being able to understand science in ways that they may not have comprehended otherwise. And they're also having a little bit more fun with it. So there's an element of play.
You were talking about the fear of failure in more of the science realm. Clearly, critique is also a part of the art world. Is there an aspect of, yes, there's the play, there's the fun perhaps in the creative process, but could there be a way of becoming maybe more comfortable with critique and criticism through this process?
Well, we have a great example at RISD at the moment. We're funded by the National Science Foundation through a state program for the experimental program to stimulate competitive research. So what we love about it is that it is experimental. And we are using the studio environment and the culture of critique to work with the scientists in the state to understand how this culture of critique could add to understanding scientific process. And it is so similar to the iterative process in the sciences that there is an ability to we have a shared language as a basis, and the culture of studio is becoming of interest for this particular program because people like Dennis are teaching classes where we have science students, we have art students, and they're sharing their different approaches. So I think Dennis will have something to say about the narrative DNA and what we're discovering through EBSCORE.
Well, yes, I'm going to step back a little bit. You were asking a question about failure and critique and whether or not the fear of failure was part of the critique process for an artist. And I think that it certainly is. One of the differences between the arts and sciences is that sciences are at least professed to be based around concrete knowledge. And that concrete knowledge can be testable. So if you give a person a math problem, simple math problem, if they get it wrong, they get it wrong. You know, if you give an artist a problem, how to draw a chair, and they draw a chair, there may be 50, 60, 100 different ways to draw the chair. And are any of them wrong? Well, some of them don't follow perspective, but does everybody have to follow the rules of perspective? It's not a testable process. It's a process of investigation. It's a process of seeing. And so my wife puts me to shame with her ability to draw. She's a master when it comes to drawing. I'm okay at it. But what happens is that I do a drawing and I look at the drawing and, you know, whereas somebody might say, oh, I've failed. This drawing is just it's a terrible drawing. I hate this drawing. Oh, how could I have possibly drawn something so bad, right? Well, that's one way of looking at it. Another way of looking at it is to say, this drawing doesn't look like the chair. This drawing looks like what my mind thought the chair was. And what it does is it gives me a way of informing myself how I am skewing my own perception of the world. You know, when I look at a chair, I don't see it's brown. I see it's this other color, or I don't care about the color of it. And when somebody asks me what color it is, you know, unless I've spent time drawing it and examining it and training myself to be perceptive and to allow all of these inputs into, then I'm really not looking at the chair. I'm looking at the way I think the chair might look, right?
No. It's interesting. I have young children in public school, and I think already we're seeing a change in the way that even some of these STEM, science, technology, engineering, math subjects are taught, even very early, that my son is being told that even if you get that math problem wrong, we want you to be able to explain why you did it that way. And it's more important to do that explanation than it is to get the answer correctly. So maybe some of this is already filtering through in some of the new curricula that we have. Babette, I wonder if you would see that perhaps as maybe not a model or direct success of STEAM, but you know, you're talking about not wanting art in service to science or vice versa, but more, I guess, an integration of the ways that we think or approach the world. So would you see that as an example of one thing that STEAM could do for us?
Oh, absolutely. And it's fascinating. We've been monitoring STEAM or things that are STEAM and not called STEAM, and there are a lot of them, over 2 years, and have geographically mapped where this is occurring across the country. Now we're looking at global, in fact. And there are a tremendous number of teachers at the grassroots level that understand that there are a lot of ways to get kids engaged, arts being one of them, this kind of problem-solving approach where there isn't necessarily a right answer, or even if there is a right answer, the asking of the question is just as relevant as the correct answer. And they're implementing this concept, this STEAM concept of asking questions, critique, and so forth, experiential learning, project-based learning, integrating the disciplines in so many ways. Many of them really are models that could be replicated throughout the public school system, but the most successful ones that we're seeing, and there are a lot of them, use the core standards, which many of the states have to follow in the public school, and depend on the core standards for art being met and depend on the core standards for whatever scientific discipline are being met. So if it's math, whatever the core standards are being met. And so there's real depth for the student in each discipline, but the students are also asked to play across the disciplines. So you're teaching not only you're not only providing different avenues in to the learning, but you're also creating students who have the ability to collaborate, which I think is a really fascinating transferable skill for the future.
So to play devil's advocate for a moment, is perhaps STEAM also too narrow, and is what we're talking about maybe something that simply harkens back to the liberal arts concept, or is it just about recognizing ourselves as a whole person and not creating these silos of science, technology, art, music, whatever those silos are, and trying to recognize that they're all interrelated?
I would definitely say that's true. And that's what I was referring to when I said things that are called STEAM and things that aren't. This is not really a new concept. Integration of disciplines at the K through 20 levels has existed for a long time. Particularly in the 70s, there was a big push for disciplinary integration. I know that in research circles, there is a lot of thought about innovation will happen at the intersection of disciplines or what occurs sort of on the edge of things. So this feeds into a sort of development of a workforce, and workforce is a heavy sort of government word to use. But essentially, we are teaching children for jobs that we can't even imagine exist yet. And so any kind of transferable skills like creativity is something that is emerging in the business community as a very desirable skill. So how do you teach creativity?
All right. Well, that's a great question. Babette Alina, Director of Government Relations at Rhode Island School of Design. We're also talking with Dennis Linsky, Professor of Fine Arts. More after a short break. Welcome back to Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. We're at Rhode Island School of Design today, exploring the benefits of integrating art and science with Professor Dennis Linsky and Babette Alina, Director of Government Relations. Before the break, we were talking about the idea that STEAM could be more than just art and science interacting, that it's actually just the breaking down of silos. Is that what you see it as Dennis?
The whole issue of silos, these bodies of knowledge or these ways of approaching knowledge that are deep and isolated, and you know, you think about that and you begin to understand the limitations of that way of approaching the world, of classifying the world into sort of individual, basically pigeonholing certain disciplines. When we talk about silos, I think that in my younger years, what I wanted to do was intervene. I wanted to break down the walls. I wanted to integrate all of the different silos into everything else. The way I feel about it right now is that I'm really, really, really happy that my lungs are a silo and that my kidney is a silo and my liver is a silo and my heart is a silo, and because they all have their own functions. They're very specialist parts of my body. Often when we try to de-silo the world, we're threatening to those folks that are in it for the long haul, right in the heart of the study. And I don't think that that's a good idea. I think those people are incredibly valuable. They've given us a tremendous amount of really good, hard knowledge. What we don't have is we don't have the endocrine system. We don't have the blood flow that goes between, you know, one silo and another. We don't have all of those interstitial connections. And the more that we try to, you know, devise ways of measuring how much somebody knows, the more we have to isolate those silos rather than to look at how those bodies of knowledge are really connecting with one another.
Who are those people then in your mind? If we follow the metaphor, we obviously need specialists. And I would say certainly in the realm of sciences, it's impossible to even be a multidisciplinary scientist in one person because we've reached such a level of knowledge and specialization. So we need the specialists. But then who are the people that are the go-betweens and the interstitial connectors?
Well, in part, I think that some of those people are the artists. You know, and they're the artists that have been denied residencies in science. Not to do science, but to be there in science to say, you know, this really looks like this other thing that I saw the other day. That there's some connection here between where I was yesterday and where I am today that you may not know because you're not part of that other lab, but I'm in these two places, and it's like there's something that's very synergistic going on here. You know, this is what a designer does. You know, an interior designer doesn't walk into a space and say, I'd like to paint it all blue. What they do is they talk to everybody. They try to figure out what the space is, how people relate to it, what has to happen there, what's the flow of people through the space, you know, whether somebody needs to be able to have a coffee machine next to their station. And then what they do is they take all of that information and they try to figure out how to connect it and how to design it so that it works in this very integrated way. I think that's something that we do at RISD extraordinarily well.
Babette, is there a difference, accepting that we're going to have and should have specialists in the adult professional realm? Is there a difference at the educational level? Maybe not even in terms of trying to make everyone good at everything, but at least ensuring that everyone who comes out of the system is able to appreciate those different specialists when they get to the professional world.
Well, one conversation I had with a group of scientists and artists recently about STEAM was, are we expecting teachers to be multidisciplinary in addition to being specialists, or are we expecting the students to be multidisciplinary? And this is one group of people, but we definitely fell on the side of teachers shall remain specialists and hopefully find ways to collaborate with other specialists so that they deliver more of an integrated curriculum, but with depth in their areas. And that the students emerging from this educational system will have more breadth. They will have enough in the specialized areas, but they will be able to speak other languages, as I spoke earlier about, so that facilitates collaboration. I think that if they specialize, which they will have to do, to your point about careers, they will at least have in the background the ability to translate their work and how it's relevant to other fields.
It seems that this sort of conversation and these sorts of efforts, I mean, as you said, the idea of integrating different disciplines, that there can be synergies that come from different specialists talking to each other. None of these are new ideas. And yet somehow whether it's our society or human beings as a whole, our default seems to be to fall back into our own silos. So what does it take to try to get us out of our silos and get us talking to each other? Do we have any successful models at this point that point to how we can try to fight this tendency?
This is a sort of side way of answering your question, but one of the motivations for STEM was to create more access and engagement for students who were not involved in their education, and particularly students that are underserved, that are not necessarily in school systems where they have resources, where certainly they don't have resources for art teachers, are falling to the wayside. And as the population changes, and we look at the future, those students in particular really need to move through the educational system successfully. And so STEM was one way to look at disciplines that produced innovation historically and would provide career paths for students and have a way to bring them into education so that they knew when they came out there was something for them. STEAM is very similar. We map onto that same narrative. It's just increasing engagement. And there is tremendous evidence that the arts provide that to students who, as I spoke about earlier, it's another door in for them. And there is fairly solid evidence that particularly students who are not engaged learners become more engaged when they have this ability to ask questions.
Talk a little bit about the EBSCOR program, which you were instrumental in getting going and how it addresses some of these challenges.
So what we're referring to is the National Science Foundation program that runs a research infrastructure development branch, and the funds are directed towards states that have historically received less of NSF's money. And the idea is that it will provide infrastructure to make those states and the researchers that reside in those states more competitive for federal competitive funding. In Rhode Island, we identified RISD as an area of strength, and in recent years, so EBSCOR has been in the state of Rhode Island for about 10 years now, and RISD is a relatively new player. We're also the only art and design school among the 26 states that are funded by EBSCOR to have an art and design school involved. So that's very unusual for NSF. And we are exploring through the studio model and critique what happens when you put artists and designers and scientists in a room together to problem solve. We've had a few studios where we approach it from both sides simultaneously. We've had some very successful studios about observation. What Dennis was saying, that sometimes artists notice things because we're looking at it in a different way that the scientists have produced but are not really recognizing. And so we've run studios with some of the scientists in the EBSCOR program that had massive amounts of data, as one example, and they couldn't really literally see what they had produced. And the studio of artists were able to do some very simplistic programming and understand patterns, recognize patterns that the scientists just hadn't had time or the ability to parse through. And those kinds of observations contribute to whatever discovery might be emerging from the work because it informs the outcome.
Dennis, tell us a little bit about your involvement with EBSCOR and what your experience has been with the program.
I've mostly sat as an artist advisor on a committee. And so the things that I've been talking about are things, they're in many ways very logistical things. What does science at RISD look like? What does science and art collaboration look like? Do we have scientists and artists both teaching in the same classroom? What's the function of a resident science in an art community? What's the function of a artist in a science community? Where is the value? And one of the things that I've been considering now is that this kind of missing element, and I think of it as a missing element. I don't think that all artists would do very well in science communities or places where research is done. I can think of a few that would be absolutely catastrophic. But there are folks that thrive in that environment. Why do they thrive?
What about the flip side of that, bringing a scientist, instead of saying an artist-in-residence program where you send an artist to become embedded in a scientific organization, what about bringing a scientist to be embedded, say, at RISD for a time?
I think that these are some of the things that we're talking about. But would every scientist be able to do that and thrive in this environment? What is that essential quality that is needed in a person? Is that trainable? Is it a skill set that we can develop and create a library of methodologies that allow certain kinds of things to, succeed and where others wouldn't? And I think that that's a really very interesting question, because I don't think that we're talking about integrating everything, but it's not that easy. Collaboration is a very, very difficult thing. There's a lot of ego involved with it. There's a lot of language problems. Scientists and artists talk about an entirely different lingo when they're talking about the work that's being done. They may be using the same words that have completely different meanings. And I think that there has to be some place, some location where those people who are especially good, both on the science side and the art side, they're especially good at these kinds of collaborations, can be trained or have access to be that interstitial element that can, move back and forth between the silos and say, oh, this is working.
Do those places exist yet?
I don't know of any. Maybe Babette has.
Well, that's what we're trying to accomplish with the EBSCOR studios. Yeah. That's exactly what we're after, and seeing how the interactions take place. What is the shared language, if that's even required? Which we do think it is required to at least have some basis of conversation. And we did have our first scientist in residence because of EBSCOR at RISD during her sabbatical, and I can tell you that she self-identified, and I believe the reason she got involved was curiosity, and it was a tremendous leap of faith for her to do it. And she asked only for a desk, came to the Nature Lab at RISD and collaborated with students. She had an open door policy. It was tremendous to have her on campus. And I don't think the outcome was what she expected, but evidently it was quite helpful.
We've been talking about language, skill set, process, things that we could teach, that if we had the right institutions and the right curricula, we could teach students these different things. But I think conventional wisdom is often that artists become artists and scientists become scientists because of fundamental differences in personality and how our brains work, left brain versus right brain. You're shaking your head, Babette. People are not fundamentally different?
I think people are fundamentally different, but I've been corrected recently by a neuroscientist that it's not as simple as left brain, right brain, and that we should probably stop talking about it that way, although it is very popular. I would say, going back to the comment I made about creativity being a very desirable skill for future jobs, successful scientists and successful artists are incredibly creative. The scientists are as creative, if not more so. If you're doing leap thinking, you have to imagine the future. And I think artists and scientists share that ability.
I've often sort of been sitting in a group of evaluators that are kind of testing, you know, they're testers. I mean, they just test everything. And as the annoying person that I can sometimes be, you know, I'll sit back and I'll say, "Do you paint?" And the question, they're startled by the question. And they say, no, I don't paint. There was this kid in the second grade who could draw absolutely wonderfully. And, you know, it's like, you're born. I mean, you're just born an artist. You know, that's just it. And I look at them and I say, well, you know, Einstein was born. Does that mean that I can't learn math? You know, it's just that if Picassos are born, certainly Einsteins are born, but there's a lot of training involved, that not everybody can be fantastic. But I think that everybody has a basic skill of being able to see their world and to be able to translate their world into an artwork. But that takes training. And it's one thing that we do at RISD is we train artists. I mean, the difference between a freshman and the way a freshman thinks when they come to the school and what they're doing as a senior, I am always astonished at the transformation. And it's wonderful.
I've long thought that every child was born a scientist, and the trick was maintaining it. And perhaps we need to add that we're all born scientists and artists, and the trick of education is to foster that.
Right. I mean, I think that it's like a bell curve, you know? It's like, I think many people have both art and science talent. There are some folks that don't have any, and there are some folks that it just comes to naturally in all of the disciplines that we've talked about. You know, but if we continue to de-emphasize, I'm the chair of the department, and so one of my jobs is to interview high school students who want to come to RISD. Over the last 5 years or 6 years, I've had a spike in students who come to me and they say, I don't know what a portfolio is. We didn't have an art program in my high school. Can I still get into RISD? Is it still possible to get into RISD? And, you know, it's just sad to me, you know?
Dennis Holinsky, Babette Alina, thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You can find links to more examples of art-science integration at RISD, as well as a slideshow from the school's Nature Lab on our website, capeandislands.org. You can also find Living Lab Radio on Facebook and Twitter. I'm Heather Goldstone. Thanks for listening.
Living Lab on the Point is produced by Heather Goldstone, with assistance from Jenny Junker and Alicia Orsini. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Brian Morris edited today's program. Major support for Living Lab is provided by the Grantham Foundation for the Protection of the Environment. Living Lab is a production of the Cape and Islands NPR stations, a service of WGBH.